Kjeld's journey to understanding his sensitive nature and its impact on his spending habits is both introspective and enlightening. His reflection on his spending habits, influenced by his father's carefree approach and his mother's frugality, showcase the profound impact of childhood experiences on adult behavior. Despite his initial fear of spending, he has gradually embraced budgeting for things he loves, like making music. His evolving mindset reflects a newfound balance between financial responsibility and enjoying the present, highlighting a journey of self-discovery and empowerment. Mike's story reminds us that understanding our unique traits and experiences can lead to improved money management and a more fulfilling financial lifestyle. Drawing from his personal encounters with anxiety and sensitivity, Mike has a deep understanding of the intricate dynamics between emotional well-being and monetary decisions. Mike is a computer programmer for money and a musician for love. You can find him on YouTube and on Bandcamp at capmikey.bandcamp.com. A genderqueer anarchist dad of three young adults, Mike lives in Philadelphia. Recovering from abusive relationships, Mike challenges himself to overcome social anxiety and build community. Because even though isolation is kind of fun, it's really hard to make a difference on your own. Listen to the full episode to hear his story. Welcome to Highly Sensitive Money, the podcast that translates money for highly sensitive people who are passionate about social justice. Today, we have a good friend of mine, Mike, who I've known for years. And Mike, I believe you self-identified almost potentially could be as highly sensitive.
Yeah. Yeah, I looked at your description and I was like, well, I mean, to me, that sounds like anxiety or a person who has dealt with trauma. But, you know, I definitely experience anxiety. And I guess in a lot of ways, I am sensitive to some things.
Yeah. And that was honestly my initial response to the term too, as someone who, like, in college, I had like a laundry list of three letter diagnoses. Like, having another label felt unhelpful, to say the least. And for me, it eventually became helpful as a financial coach and seeing who my work resonated with the most. And it was kind of like, oh, wow, I keep really serving people who, because the good part about, or the positive side, because it's a double side, everything has a positive and a negative. That positive side of being highly sensitive is like seeing all of the connections, right? How one money decision can have so many things that it affects. And it's also, you're just more sensitive. So you're getting more input and you can make more connections. That's the best way that I see it. How does that sit with you?
I think that makes sense. You know, I actually took a quiz this morning. I just found a random YouTube video from like a neurodivergent channel, and they were talking about monotropism. And there's this new questionnaire called the monotropism questionnaire. And so I took it, and the questions were all like, when I'm interested in a topic, I like to learn everything I can about that topic. Or, I don't mind if someone interrupts me when I'm in the middle of an activity. I strongly disagree with that one. And I tend to do activities because I find them interesting instead of due to societal expectations. There was one that reminded me of Richard Feynman, the physicist. The sense of the questions reminded me of the book, Surely You're Joking, Mr. Feynman, where he talked to, he was one of the greatest physicists of the 20th century. And he made some really essential advancements in the understanding of quantum mechanics, but he did all kinds of things. And his book was all about his hobbies, where he picked something up and he'd get pretty good at it, and then he'd lose interest and try something else. And, you know, as a kid, I always felt ashamed for doing that. I'm like, oh, I just can't stick with anything. And to hear that, like, one of the greatest minds of the 20th century did the same thing. I was like, maybe it's okay that I get excited about stuff and then I lose interest. Maybe it's fine to do that.
Yeah. And that brings me to the idea of neurodivergence, which is feels like it's becoming more common. Like, I'm more aware of it now than I was 10 years ago. And high sensitivity as a neurodivergence is new to me, but I also know that they've been doing research on it for 30 years.
Yeah, and the idea of monotropism sounds like it's a little bit different from other definitions of autism in the sense that it's really about being hyper-focused, about kind of having tunnel vision on a particular subject. And, you know, my parents would call me a Johnny One Note. And just like, you know, maybe I have ADD, I don't know, but my attention span is very limited. It's like not necessarily in time, but in focus. So like I can really only focus on one thing, and I hate multitasking.
Okay. So we talked about the high sensitivity, potentially high sensitivity or monotropism. What about on the money side? Can you share a little bit about like what money was like growing up?
I've described myself for most of my life as like penny wise and pound foolish. Like I'm terrified of spending money. And a lot of the time I'll like do without because I don't want to spend money. I'm afraid of running out of money. And then I'll find something that I'm excited about, or like, you know, I'll be on a trip where I'm not really thinking about my day-to-day routine, and I'll just drop a huge amount of money. And my dad was like that. I loved the way my dad spent money, actually. He would spend money on things that got him excited, and we would do really exciting projects together. And for the most part, he was pretty broke, and like basic needs were minimally met. But when I was with him, I was always having a great time, so I didn't care that much. So I think I kind of brought that with me in terms of the way I deal with money, where I'm really stingy with things where I don't have to be. And then I kind of spend too much because I don't want to worry about how to optimize my spending. I just want to do the thing.
So it's very like back and forth, like the pendulum swings very broadly.
Yeah.
Is that how you're doing money now, the way that your dad did it?
I think less so now. I mean, I right now I budget for things that I love to do, right? I have a budget for making music. I have a budget for going out. Like I never had that before. I started a budget for buying clothes. Like I had this idea for a long time that I just wouldn't buy clothes. I'd like wear clothes until they completely fell apart. And I'm interested in mending now, but actually, in the interest of mending and making clothes last, I made myself a budget to buy materials, to mend my clothes, to buy clothes that will last. And that feels really good just to like say, hey, I can afford this and this is how much I can afford. I've worked it out and I know it's okay. So now I can spend this money.
I completely, completely understand that. So I don't know if we've talked about this, but I teach this thing called money archetypes, and I compare it to different types of trees. So the one that I'm hearing from you, or the one that I identified it with myself, it's a saguaro, so that when it rains, it floods. And when it doesn't rain, you have no idea when it's going to rain again, right? So there's a lot of this tendency to hoard. And for myself, when I gave myself like, this is how much I get to spend on fun. And I could either give it away to someone that's houseless on the street, or I could burn it, or I could spend it all on clothes. Like it just gave me so much freedom because I knew that everything else was being covered. It's like giving yourself permission.
Yeah. I'm still having a lot of anxiety about it because I want to spend a lot more money on making music. And I realize that my budget for gifts is really low, and I want to get Christmas presents for my kids, and I somehow there's nothing there. So I have a lot of tweaks to make, I think, but in overall terms, things are going really well. And you know, my son asked for college tuition. He's going to community college. It wasn't a huge amount, but you know, it's college tuition. It's not nothing. And I had it. I can pay for that. And that felt really good. And I'm like, a couple of things are feeling a little off right now because of that. The rest of my budget's a little bit low, but I have enough money for everything that I need. And I know that after the next couple of paychecks, everything will balance out. So there's stress, but I'm learning to trust that the money will be there.
Mm-hmm. But you said that your dad's relationship with money was really feast or famine, right? That sometimes yeah. The basics would not be covered. Has that been your experience as an adult, the way you've managed money for yourself?
I think more so when I was married, actually. Since I got divorced, I've been focusing much more on self-care. And I should say that I I haven't lived with my dad since my parents got divorced when I was four. So that was kind of the vacation time, spending weekends with my dad. I saw him every other weekend. And then when he moved away, I would see him for a month in the summer. That was my vacation. That was the fun time. And so I didn't have to live with the day-to-day scarcity. My mom married someone who had a very comfortable income, and all the basic needs were always provided for. We never had to worry about that, but they were very stingy with fun. So I got sort of two contrasting perspectives on money.
Okay. That makes sense. It makes sense to go from one extreme to the other with two very different households.
Yeah.
And you talked about, when you were preparing for this interview, we talked about self-care and not making the world worse, right? And that's part of like the social justice. And I know that that's a big part of what is important to you.
Yeah.
One of the things that you said was that you feel now that existing does not make the world worse, you know, and I get this because sometimes I think of myself like, oh my gosh, I'm in a first world country and I use so many resources just by the very fact that I'm in this country. When you're in the US, it's like the US uses 25% of the world's resources and is like 8% of the population, maybe lower than that. Mm. So it can sometimes feel like just my existence is contributing to the problem. And yet that's not the whole picture.
Yeah.
Right. How are you navigating self-care and not making the world worse with the question of social justice, of balancing it out, right? Of not martyring myself to the benefit of others, of including myself in humanity. I think I've written about this recently of just my well-being is also important. And there was a quote that I saw recently by Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. But to paraphrase, what he was saying is that if you have the freedom to be all of, like, it is necessary for you to have the freedom to be all of who you are in order for me to have the freedom to be all of who I am. Like, I need to be able to be the best version of me. And that requires that you also have the freedom to be the best version of you. And that interrelatedness was just, it's a beautiful way of looking at social justice, not as in like, here I come to save you, or here I must like minimize myself. It's instead of it being like all or nothing or like a zero sum game, it's much more of like an expanding worldview, of an abundant worldview.
Yeah, it reminds me of, I think, Marianne Williamson. I think she's a Quaker who, there was a quote that was attributed to Nelson Mandela about our greatest fear is not that we're powerless, but that we're too powerful. And by shining brightly, we give others permission to shine.
Yeah, I know for myself, when I read about what it means to be highly sensitive, that was one of the things that came on often, that came up in like the research that I was doing, feeling the pain of the world, having access to the pain of the world. And it feels like a lot of people are numb to it. And then I feel like, oh, what's wrong with me that I'm so sensitive to the pain of the world?
Yeah,
there's nothing wrong with me. I just am. And yeah, and I'm able to take action now.
I think I've heard people talk about empathy and say that, you know, sometimes they say people with autism don't lack empathy. They have too much empathy. I don't want to argue that point. I think it might be a little bit silly, but, you know, there's another concept I learned about called enmeshment where, and I have other people say like compassion is more what they're going for than empathy, but you know, whatever you call it, I think there's a difference between imagining how another person feels, like being able to recognize how another person feels versus actually trying to feel what another person feels. Because if I feel another person's pain, if I literally feel that pain, I can't help that person. I'm just going to suffer, right? That doesn't help them. But if I can understand where they're coming from, if I can relate to it and say, well, I've felt like that. I know what that feels like, But right now I'm in a place of strength, right? I'm in a place where I feel secure about myself. I have enough hope in the world that I can offer something to that person. I can be there for that person without just getting kind of dragged down. So that was a totally new concept to me when I first heard about it, maybe like 7 years ago or so. But it was really exciting. It was like, hey, it's okay for me to feel good when other people are suffering. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that I am benefiting from their suffering or causing their suffering. And in fact, it means that I might be better equipped to help.
Yeah, because you're more present for them. And yeah, that definitely has taken some learning for me too, of like other people's pain does not immediately mean that I have to feel the pain with them.
Yeah.
Like that. And it's holding the paradox. It's very much holding the paradox of how there's so many things in life that we can't solve. I was talking to someone earlier today that said that the first part of change is acceptance. Like once you accept what ground you're standing on, then you can start to make changes.
Wow. I've been thinking about that a lot lately because, you know, for the first like 5 or 6 years after my divorce, I was just 100% focused on self-care. And I felt like I'm going to be really selfish right now because I haven't been selfish enough. But at a certain point, I was like, well, I've been hearing this story that if I let myself be selfish, I will be able to contribute to the world. But I don't feel like I'm doing it. I feel like I'm just being selfish and I'm just taking and not giving. So in the last couple of years, I've been trying to figure out, well, how can I find a balance? Because in the past, where I built my entire value on being needed and being useful to other people, I ended up being really resentful. You know, I worked harder and harder. And I think if I only get better at giving, then I will eventually get what I need. I will be appreciated and loved and needed, and I'll be satisfied with that. But it didn't work out. I just ended up getting more and more resentful that I wasn't getting back what I was putting out. And, you know, eventually I realized that what I was putting out was often codependent and wasn't really helping people anyway. I had to step back from that and feel what selfishness looks like. And now I'm like, okay, I want to learn something new. I want to learn how to give, to be of use to others or contribute to the world without compromising myself, without giving away what I can't afford to give.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that brings me to one of the topics you've talked about before, effective altruism, right? The movement of effective altruism. Do you feel comfortable like introducing people to the movement, to the concept, if they're not aware of it?
I will do my best. I'll probably just start by recommending there's a video by the YouTube channel Philosophy Tube, where they talk about effective altruism.
And we can include it in the show notes.
Great. Yeah. The title of that video is something like Rich People Have Their Own Ethics. Like I first heard about effective altruism on an ad on another YouTube video. And they were saying there's this website called 80,000 Hours. It's called 80,000 Hours because that's about the amount of time you spend working at your job in your life. And this website can help you choose a job that will make the world a better place. And I was like, oh, that sounds awesome. Like, that's what I wanted to do since I started working. And it's always been very frustrating that I can't do that. You know, I just have to make a paycheck. And it seems like every job I've ever worked that comes at the price of, you know, advancing capitalism and making the rich richer and all of these things that I don't believe in. But that's where the paychecks come from. So I was excited to hear about this website where maybe you can find a better job. So I started getting into it. I listened to a podcast where it was really aimed at young people, and it was actually aimed at rich young people, because what they were saying was, well, if you're interested in this, this is what you should get your PhD in. And I'm like, I have a master's degree. I'm very grateful for that. You know, I got that because I got my bachelor's degree because my parents had enough money to pay my way through college. I had no debt when I graduated from college. Very grateful for that. I got my master's degree when I was working at the University of Pennsylvania. It was basically free. I'm very privileged in that way, but there's no way I'm going to get a PhD to change careers. I'm over 50 years old, and I'm just not interested in that. I don't really believe that that is how I can do the most good in the world. But, you know, I'm listening to what they're saying, who this is for. It sounds like young people who have that opportunity, who can put that much into their higher education that they can get a PhD and choose the field that they work in. So first, from the very start, I was getting some red flags. But I signed up for a program where you could learn about effective altruism. There was like a bunch of readings to do and weekly discussions. And I had a lot of fun in the discussions. But also things kept coming up that bothered me. I don't want to be judgmental of anyone's ethical choices. And I want to be really careful about this. Personally, I eat meat. And I tried eating less meat. There were times in my life when I eat less meat. And I didn't feel good physically and emotionally. And I decided that wasn't for me. I had said at one point in my life that if I was going to be comfortable eating meat, I was going to have to learn to hunt, to be able to kill or slaughter an animal. And I did that. And I found that it is a very unpleasant thing to do. Like I can imagine someone who had to do that every day, it would change the way they felt a lot of things, not necessarily in good ways. And now I'm very grateful that someone else does it for me, but I still eat meat. Having said that, I do have a lot of shame about it. I do fear that, you know, there's this Peter Singer argument that saying animals are okay to kill and eat is akin to racism and slavery. And like, I don't know if I agree with that, but that idea is in my head and I can't get it out. So when I heard the people in the effective altruism talk about how like a lot of people in effective altruism do believe that like the next moral step for humanity is to recognize the personhood of animals, of the animals that we use and eat, I got uncomfortable. And along with that, you know, one of the reasons that I've never been super on board with that is I think it's a great idea to, you know, try to be compassionate and just to all beings in the universe. That's a great idea. But we are so far from that as a people. So that was one thing I was uncomfortable with. And I think
altruism, what it does is that it tries to be very like numbers oriented and how do philanthropy, right?
Yeah. So the idea behind effective altruism is they're utilitarians. They use utilitarian philosophy to measure good. And they just like evaluate as many things going on in the world as they can. And they say, what is the good of this thing? Like sometimes they have actual units. They have things like a thing called qualies, which is quality adjust life years, I think. So they're saying that like if you can extend a person's life, that is a good. But if you can improve the quality of a person's life, that's also good. But of course, if you're measuring things like that, you might end up measuring like euthanasia as a good. Like if somebody is suffering, you might decide that they are better off dead. Or if you measure that the suffering of animals caused by humans who eat or farm or use animals is so great that it's worth more than a human life, then the solution is to exterminate humans. And someone actually brought up that argument in one of our discussions. But also alongside this sort of Peter Singer argument about recognizing the lives of animals as the next step in our morality, there's sort of this idea of progress baked in there, that we are more moral than humans were 100 years ago, and we will be more moral 100 years from now. And the best thing we can do is figure out what we will be like in the future after we've made more progress. And I realized kind of midway through this course that I don't think I agree with this concept of progress. after I took the course and I read a little bit about effective altruism, I realized that a lot of these types of reasoning are actually motivated by privilege. Like worrying. So one of the popular aspects of effective altruism is long-termism. This idea that we should do the most good for people 1,000 years in the future. And that means making sure that humanity doesn't go extinct. And I heard someone say a little later that worrying about humanity going extinct is the kind of thing that people do when they don't have to worry about their own lives. It's a very privileged attitude. And there's so many people now whose lives are under threat, whose quality of life is very bad, who probably aren't worried about humanity going extinct because they have bigger things to worry about. And it really changed my perspective on effective altruism. I was already kind of feeling doubtful about it, and that was kind of the last straw. So,
yeah, one of the arguments I've heard against this movement, which I know was very helpful for many people, there's a book called Decolonized Wealth by Edgar Villanueva, and he talks about how in philanthropy, it's often easier for people to donate to Africa than to donate to like Black organizations in their own city.
And effective altruism effectively justifies that. They say, oh, well, people's lives in Africa are so bad and things there are so cheap that you spend a dollar there, you can save 50 lives or whatever. So you're doing better there. That's built into the philosophy.
Yeah. And it ignores, like, it doesn't, the thing about philanthropy too, and I don't know if this was the case in effective altruism, but philanthropy often doesn't or isn't able to or doesn't actually change the causes of the problem.
And like they talk about multipliers a little bit, but I felt like they did way too little to address root causes. And a lot of their calculations of good, I thought, were vastly underestimating the amount of uncertainty involved in every intervention that they propose. Mm-hmm. And especially when it comes to structural change, right? There's a huge amount of uncertainty. So they didn't even consider it a lot of the time. And, you know, to me, structural change is the only possibility to really make a difference in the world. Like, and, you know, I don't want to discount doing good for people within the system. Like, I'm sure that a lot of people's lives are better because of charity that they experience. But to me, I'm not interested in that. I see structural issues that are causing basically everything that I don't like about my life. And I want to change them. And I'm trying to be realistic about like how much they will change in my lifetime. But that doesn't mean I'm giving up. I have a lot of other thoughts about that lately, but I don't know if they're relevant right now.
And when it comes to money, how you do money, how did effective altruism change the way you did your money day to day or the way you thought about money?
Yeah, I think it did. When I first heard about it, it was also around the time that I first got my current job. I am making like double what I've ever made in my life before this time. It's a lot of money. And, you know, it's never enough. I'm pretty good spending everything I make. I do save, but I'm planning to spend that all in the house. So I was like, I am making enough money that I can donate to charity now. I'd never done that in my life. So that was another reason I got interested in effective altruism. And so the first year that I heard about it, I donated to like the Future of Life Institute, the Future of Humanity Institute. Effective altruism is also, they put a big emphasis on AI safety. They believe that's like the biggest existential threat to humanity right now. And they want to put way more investment into that. So I was like, and I was concerned about it, you know, in my previous job, I actually worked on providing training data to DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Association. And that's basically what my stepdad did. Like, I feel like I've been in the war most of my career without really intending to. You know, I was working in a linguistics lab, but that data was going towards basically biotechnology, processing massive amounts of data in order to extract information about enemies of the state. You know, they never ever said that out loud, but I'm pretty sure that's what the data was being used for. So I was generating data sets for machine learning algorithms. And, you know, I'm very much a fan of the Terminator franchise. And like, I don't think that will literally happen, but I think there are risks involved with like handing over our power to machines we don't understand. And just the whole idea that there are drones, right? There are drones that kill people. And there's a human in the loop, as they say. Just like even landmines, right? It's just like automating warfare. And I don't agree with that. So I wanted to do something good. That's why I donated to those organizations that were involved in AI safety. But my perspective's changed a lot since then. I haven't given anything to charity this year. I made myself a budget for it and somehow it's all gone. I'm not sure. I think I've just been like, I've started giving cash to people on the street every now and then. I never did that in my life. I believe the stories that it was a waste, that, you know, that you should give to charity or local institutions instead. And I'm not sure about that anymore. And sometimes I think maybe it's better just to give money to the people who need it. But I don't know. I really don't know.
How did effective altruism change the way that you do money or think about money?
Yeah, so I think in the short term, it had me giving to charities, which is basically one of their biggest steps that they talk about. And in the long term, I became like an anarchist and really became much more critical of capitalism. You know, I always thought that as like a young person, like I would be more rebellious, more against the system. And as I got older, I'd start to accept it or whatever. But I feel like at my age, like I'm 51 now, I've never been more radical. I've never believed more that the system is fundamentally wrong and anti-human and needs to change.
Do you think being a father is part of that? Or do you think you would have gotten to that place without having children?
I think it helps, like, especially when it comes to the climate, like just knowing that the harm that's being done now will affect them and will affect their children if they choose to have children even more than it affects me. It gives me a stake in the future, but I don't know how I would have been if I hadn't had kids. I really wanted to have kids. So I don't even know what kind of world there would have been when I didn't have kids.
Yeah. And when you say anarchism, do you mean like libertarianism? Do you mean little minimum government? Like what is, tell me what you mean.
Yeah. So I've been learning a lot about anarchism. So, you know, when I was a teenager, the only thing I knew about anarchism was the Sex Pistols, right? The anarchy in the UK. Mm-hmm. And it didn't sound super appealing. It just sounded like breaking stuff. And I mean, disobeying rules is kind of fun, but I was never really into that. I was mostly a rule follower. So like anarchism sounded like vaguely threatening and probably not productive.
Yes, but everything more capitalist in you is like, that doesn't sound like it's going to be profitable. Like, or even that fun.
Yeah, yeah.
You talked about morality and legality, right?
Yeah. But I've been learning more about anarchism and just like, I've always been pretty anti-authoritarian. Like I've always been resentful about authority. Like what does authority do besides take away your freedom? I'm not sure. You know, and there's claims that authority gives us order and safety, but I believe them less and less. You know, I've been hearing a lot about cops lately and, you know, in situations where cops have refused to work or not been available, sometimes violence goes down, prosperity goes. What I've been learning is that like, there's really only one job that cops have. They don't, you know, I think this has come out in the public recently that police are, at least in the United States, they are not obligated to help people. So the only job they really have is to protect money, to protect capital.
Property.
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember hearing that what we now have as police used to be to catch runaway enslaved people.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And that's how that mentality continues.
That's how police in the United States originated.
And it was about property, right? Back when people were property.
Yeah.
And there's something you talked about earlier about expanding personhood. I feel that that's something that's been happening. Like when the United States was founded in like, what, the 1776, who had personhood? White men who were property holders.
Mm-hmm. Right?
No one else.
Yeah.
It excluded white men who did not own property. There's so many things. And that's expanded and changed since then.
Yeah. I do want to expand that perspective a little bit in the terms of the idea of progress, where the institution of the United States, the institution of chattel slavery as we know it, are relatively new. I was listening to a podcast recently where they were saying like about 600 years ago, there was a Catholic Church issued a decree that basically said it was okay to conquer foreign lands and take slaves. And that's sort of where this era of capitalism and exploitation of people began. It hasn't been like that forever. And so when we talk about progress, well, like there are areas where we can make progress and I would like to. But I don't ever want to get stuck thinking that this is the way it always was, because that leads to hopelessness. There was a great book that I read called, I'm blanking on the name now. It's by David Graeber and David Wengrow. And it is called The Dawn of Everything. Yeah. And, you know, among anthropologists, there's some disagreement about the details that they go into, the conclusions they make about archaeological finds. But their broad strokes, I think, were really, really helpful and insightful. Basically just saying what we think of as how the world is, just the way things are, the way human nature is so much shaped by the context that we live in. And this is just a moment in history. Mm-hmm. And human beings are capable of organizing themselves in so many different ways. And they have in the past, and they will in the future.
Yeah. That's actually a very hopeful note.
Yeah, right. I really encourage everyone to read this book, The Dawn of Everything. They talk about not only about how Hobbes was short-sighted, but also how Rousseau, who I believe didn't actually use the phrase the noble savage himself, but he did oversimplify this idea that the state of nature is peaceful and ideal. You know, and they describe how insulting that is to the people who both Hobbes and Rousseau were calling savages.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to bring this book up recently. It's called We Have Never Been Modern by Bruno Latour. It's philosophy. I have not read a lot of philosophy. It was very dense and hard to read. But he talks about the sort of artificial divide that people who call themselves modern create, both between society and nature and between their society and pre-modern societies. You know, they're too aware of our history to call them primitive anymore, but it still has this bias that there is some kind of fundamental divide between modern society and the rest of the world. And according to Bruno Latour, it's a fiction. And I think I agree with that. The book is way more complicated than that. I don't think I'm doing a good job of getting the detail. He also talks about history and the idea of revolutions that these, you know, the Green Revolution, the Industrial Revolution, the Agricultural Revolution, these ideas, the idea that these changes erased history. First of all, these things took time. They didn't happen in an instant. And they didn't erase anything. We're still connected to everything in our past, not just our era. Anyway, that's another digression.
Yeah, but we're talking about money and how a person who has a very wide view of it, because you honestly do, Mike, like there's so many things that you think about as you're making decisions, how all of these things come in and how you navigate it. And it can be very messy. And yet that's kind of where we live. We live in the messy middle. There's hardly anything that's ever resolved. Yeah. And it's very anti-Western thinking, I believe. Like it's much more like a mystical thinking of like everything's not resolvable. And yet we still continue to move on.
That's very non-modern of you.
Maybe it's very female of me too, like very feminine. Yeah. Like,
I wish I could understand this book. I want more people to read it, and maybe they can explain it to me.
Videos on it explaining it. That's so. Mike and I are reading The Divine Comedy, and I'm watching. So I'm listening to so many podcasts. I am watching so many commentaries on it to like even understand what it is that I'm reading. Enjoying it though.
Well, I'm just enjoying reading out loud.
This weird pattern that Dante created. Mike, it's been a pleasure to talk with you about money and all of the things that it brings up. I really appreciate your time and thank you.
Thank you, Deanna. I feel like I hardly covered anything. I really enjoyed speaking with you and yeah, it's great to be here today.
Thank you. All right. Welcome back, Mike. So this is our follow-up conversation after our initial recording. And this time we're going to dive a little bit more into music specifically and how, and like some things that you just wanted to add to the conversation.
Yeah. So after our last conversation, I realized I didn't talk very much about my own experience. I kept getting distracted by stuff and going off on tangents. And the funny thing is right after that, I watched a video about monotropism, which is a new thing that people into autism are talking about, I guess. And I really related to what they were saying about it, about like basically the idea that a person is with monotropism is like super focused, but only on one thing. And so like, you know, I often think of myself as someone who might have ADD, but it's because I don't multitask. I really focus on one thing and then I get distracted by another thing and I focus on that thing, but I can't like process both at once.
Do you feel ready to focus on money and you?
Let's try.
And that's a real question, because when we were having our last conversation, I do remember being like, oh, he's not talking a lot about money. And it also just like, it's okay. It's such a taboo subject. It's so personal. We circle around things, and that's okay.
I appreciate that. You know, I've been kind of anxious. Like I thought the last conversation would be like more relaxed, but I was feeling a lot of time pressure. And so let's give it a try.
So let's talk about specifically about money and music. Tell me about music and tell me how money supports it or doesn't support it.
Okay. So, I mean, my dream is really to just play music. I mean, I don't want to only play music, you know, like I like playing games and hanging out with people and having time to myself and all that normal stuff. But like as the main focus of my life, I want to play music. And lately I've been realizing I don't just want to play music and record music at home. I want to play music for other people. I want to play music with other people. And my job, I appreciate that it pays the bills, but it really doesn't fulfill that need. Even though I'm a computer programmer and I like programming too, I probably do that for fun as well. But the balance is off for me.
Okay, so the balance is off, and yet you are, like, you have band practice today. After this, you're, like, literally going somewhere to be with music. Yeah.
It feels like a different kind of compromise right now. I feel like I had a more peaceful life before I started trying to play music with other people or out of the house. and I like had a regular sleep schedule. And I feel like I've compromised some of that. I'm more stressed overall, but the compensation is that I have a more fulfilling life.
Mm-hmm. I always hear of that, like when it comes to children, right? That like early childhood is one of the most stressful times for parents, but it's also a lot of fun. When they look back, it's kind of like childbirth. When you're in it, you're like, this is horrible. And when you look back, you're like, eh, it happened.
That is an interesting comparison. And I am, in some sense, an empty nester. My kids haven't lived with me for about 7 years, but I see them pretty regularly. But they're becoming young adults now. They're going to college. So it is kind of a time for me to explore my own interests again.
And maybe it's not as stressful as having young children.
<laughs> I imagine. Probably not.
Yeah. So how does money relate to music?
So I'm terrible at the big picture. The first thing that came to mind was busking. Like my first idea for how to get out and play music live and like experience that, you know, when I'm recording at home, I can, if I mess up, I can just go back and fix it. I wanted to have that experience of playing live. I know it can be really good for learning performance, and it's a great experience. But what I didn't realize was that people were going to give me money. I left my case open in case they wanted to, but I didn't know if that would happen. It basically happened right away. And, you know, it's not a living. It's a very small amount of money. And it doesn't happen every time. But it adds this dynamic to it that's really interesting to me. It kind of gives me confidence that if I did quit my job, I could maybe piece together a living.
Is it more relational though? I mean, here are people literally giving you money for playing.
Yeah, no, it does feel like they're showing me appreciation. I often like feel like I don't deserve it, as I do have a regular income and I don't need it. But what ended up happening was a guy came up to me and he said, "Hey, you know, I'm homeless. I need money. Do you have anything for me?" And I said, "Look, if I make any money playing, I'll give it to you." And I've seen him almost every week, and I've been doing that. I just give him what I get, and it feels good. I don't know if he's going to be around. Last time I saw him, he said he was moving to Scranton. He got an apartment. So sounds like good news for him. He was really appreciative, and it was I had a great conversation. But that was an interesting way to deal with that kind of discomfort of like, I want to be able to make money. I don't need to make money. What do I do with it?
That's super interesting. And that's an experience you wouldn't have had if you hadn't desired to play in public. And I get that. It's like, I love cooking, and I love cooking for myself. In fact, sometimes when other people come and eat what I cook, I think, oh, you know, those were going to be my leftovers all week. So there's this like selfishness that can happen. Yeah. And yet sometimes I really am like, wow, this is delicious. I wish I had someone to share it with.
Yeah.
So there is that sharing that's happening when you're busking.
Yeah.
What percentage of your budget do you think goes to music right now? And how much would you like it to go to music?
Oh, I have these numbers somewhere.
Just tell me, like,
I guess maybe like 2%, something like that. Maybe between 2 and 5%, I think. I recently kind of reallocated my budget. I noticed I wasn't spending as much on some other things, so I kind of reallocated them to music. But most of my music budget goes towards saxophone lessons. And I'd like to buy some equipment whenever I'm working on a music video. I'm like, oh, I'd like all this photography equipment, you know, a backdrop and good lighting. And I don't even have a camera. I just use my phone. And so I'm okay, I think, for audio equipment mostly. But for video equipment, I'd really like to get a lot more. And when I looked at the budget, I was like, it's going to be a long time before I save up enough to buy any of those things.
Mm-hmm. What, when, how's that feel?
It's okay. Like I keep one of my role models is Andrew Huang, a YouTuber who makes music and music videos. And he said a few times, he said, you can make music with anything. You can do this with anything. If you just have a phone and a computer, you can, you know, it's nice to have equipment and there's always more you can get, but just work with what you have. And I really like that philosophy.
I'm thinking of, wasn't there a movie that won several awards? Oh my gosh, it's a movie about transvestites in LA and it was done on a phone.
Was that Paris is Burning? No, that was older. People wouldn't have had phones.
No, Moonbeam.
I didn't hear about it.
But it's possible, right? This movie was incredible and it was just amazing that it was done on a phone. A lot of the time, yeah, my personal, and it could be just because I tend to be more of an aesthetic, like not wanting to have anything, honestly. But a lot of the times we think like a thing is going to make the end result better. But it's mostly just like, do you have the patience and the practice and the resilience to keep doing it?
You know, that reminds me of something though. After I got divorced, I was like really, really kind of stung by the experience that I had in the marriage with money. I felt out of control. I felt like it wasn't okay for me to spend money and my partner was spending money that I didn't feel okay about. You know, I'm sure everybody involved in that had their own experience of that. I don't know if they would match up, but my feeling coming out of that was I didn't want to own anything. I didn't want to have anything to lose. And I had a small apartment. I didn't have a lot of stuff and I feel good about that. But over time I started wanting, you know, I wanted to do music more and I decided to start collecting musical instruments. So I've moved away from this of like nothing to lose kind of experience. And I've started, and you know, whenever I want a musical instrument, whenever my kids want a musical instrument, I try to make that happen. And it's been really fulfilling. I really like it. You know, I went to the thrift store with my kid not long ago and I got a lap steel guitar, a sort of Hawaiian style electric slide guitar. And, you know, it was cheap. I don't really have any regrets about it. You know, sometimes I can get instruments for free. Like my son said, his friend has a trombone that they don't want that I might get. So, but just the idea of collecting musical instruments and like being willing to spend money on that, it feels freeing. I don't feel like so much trapped in this situation I was in before where the money was out of control and I just wanted to shut it all down.
Mm-hmm. That makes a lot of sense. Yeah, it's been ages since I shared finances with someone, but I do remember because I was the breadwinner in the relationship. And when I started making more money, they started spending more. And I was like, don't you know we're going to pay off debt sooner because I'm making more money? And it was just different. It was a different mindset. And they were also like, do you know how long we've been living without? Hmm. Right? So it was both things were true. And having conversations.
I wonder a lot about my quality of life. Like if I chose to retire early, what kind of quality of life could I accept, right? Like when I was looking at retirement calculators, they were kind of on the assumption that you'd spend sort of an equivalent proportion of your current income, no matter how much you're currently making. And I kept wondering, like, could I live on a lot less? What would my life be like? Because that would give me the freedom to do more of, you know, to have the time, my time.
Yeah, there's a book called Your Money or Your Life by Vicky.
I read that book.
Yeah. I think it's Joe Rodriguez and I'm forgetting Joe's last name too, but it's Vicky and Joe are the authors, the joint authors. Mm-hmm. And they talk a lot about that. Like if your lifestyle is very, very inexpensive, if you live on 20% of what you make and you save the other 80%, you could become employment free pretty quickly. Also, but I mean, a lot of the people, and that's kind of what became the FIRE movement, financial independence, retire early. A lot of those people though they work in tech like yourself. So maybe it is possible. But they're also like, starting super, I mean, I don't, there's different ways that they get about to it, but it's a good
question. My hope was that I'd be able to pay my house off and get some improvements done to my house to make it lower maintenance and cheaper to live in, you know, like getting more efficient heating and cooling, insulation, that kind of, I don't feel like I have enough money to do that right now. And that's one thing I'm like, I always wonder, like, am I spending too much on something else or is this reasonable?
Mm-hmm. And it's such an internal question.
Yeah.
I think of, yeah. And I was talking, I mean, I may have talked about this in our last conversation, but there's a friend of mine, her name is Haley Castillo. She's a financial therapist. And she talks about that there's a movement called intuitive eating, the intuitive eating movement where you learn to listen to your body. And she says she'd love to be part of bringing that to money.
I feel like I've heard of that.
So intuitive eating is super helpful and it's been very helpful. So anybody who's been socialized as a woman, like being thinner, I think it's definitely there for men too, but it's really strong for the positive thing, like the thing about intuitive eating that we don't see in money is that intuitive eating, there's a lot of role models of people who have a positive relationship with food or at least a neutral relationship with food. Whereas with money, it's harder to come by people who have even a neutral relationship with money.
That makes sense.
And I work with people across the wealth spectrum. You know, one of the things that makes me think about, I mean, it could be a positive relationship with money. Millionaires Next Door, that's a book that was written ages ago, and they have follow-ups. And they talk a lot about people who spend a small percentage of what they earn. And Now, and Millionaire Next Door, it has points about when people spend on a lot of, like, the more money people have, the less flashy they are. So it was kind of like being an oversaver. I don't know if that's also the route that's right for everyone, but I know that it's a clear path to freedom or like wage freedom within our current capitalist system. I see you're frowning.
I read Your Money or Your Life, and I've thought a lot about like how I can save money over my life. Like, I've never owned a car. I've tried to save on how, you know, until recently I didn't spend a lot on clothes. I still don't spend a whole lot on clothes. The one area I do spend a lot on is food because I try to get high quality food. But after all that, like when I read about kind of frugal living or downsizing, I always wonder, like, what else can I do? Because I still don't feel like I have enough. And so I like hearing practices like that, but somehow I think I'm not doing it right.
Okay, so this friend of mine was saying when she was wondering, like when thinking about retirement, how much is enough? And she realized that there's no amount that would be enough, honestly, because you could always create or imagine a catastrophe that could wipe her out. Hmm. And that's when she realized that her terror around financial ruin had little to do with the number in the bank.
Uh-huh.
Right. And what does that mean? It means like, I remember when I was in my eating disorder days, I was in a 12-step group and my sponsor would say like, the only acceptable weight is birth weight. I love your response. And like all of us would laugh because honestly, that was probably like the only time in our life that we were like, yeah, I think I weigh the right amount, you know? Full-grown adult women being like, I wish I weighed single digits, you know, just the insanity.
Wow.
And that was, I think we live in a culture that like just doesn't know a lot about having enough.
Yeah.
And maybe we get to be okay with that discomfort. Like it's not something that can be solved because we live, like we often think that more money can create safety and that's not true.
I've lately been trying to spend more on kind of day-to-day pleasures, like, you know, going out to shows, going out to restaurants, getting gifts from my kids, things that I would feel guilty about when I was trying to be frugal. But actually talking to you, you know, giving me some percentages around like how I might want to spend my money, like, it kind of gave me the permission to enjoy those things.
Yeah, it's learning that balance, because it just depends on what helps people feel safe. Like, I know what I need, and that amount has changed as I've become more confident in my ability to earn, right? So thank you, Mike, for coming back on and sharing more deeply around you and money.
Yeah.
And I know that, yeah.
Thanks for the chance. It's like, I was kind of unsatisfied after our last talk, because I was just like all over the place thinking about other things.
Which I think is so normal, which is why I'm always so grateful that people even have one-on-one coaching sessions. It's an honor always to be in part of people's journey, but then to do it on a podcast where it's going to be recorded and shared, that's a different level. So I so appreciate you for being part of the first season of Highly Sensitive Money.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate it.
In this episode, we delved into the concept of intuitive spending and its impact on our financial well-being. It's not just about the numbers in our bank account, but also understanding our behaviors and beliefs around money. Thank you for joining us today. I'm your host, Diana Giselle Yanez. Did you enjoy this episode? Please share this first season of Highly Sensitive Money with others. To learn how you can upskill your money relationship, join the newsletter over at allthecolors.net. That's allthecolors.net for network. Take care, and remember, you've got what it takes to feel good about your money.